Welcome to NACSW's Podcast of the Month. Our podcast program makes available recordings of a wide variety of NACSW presentations and discussions on topics of particular interest to Christians in social work. Our Podcast of the Month program features a new podcast every 30 days for your listening pleasure. We hope you enjoy today's podcast.
I'm honored to introduce our plenary speaker, the Alan Keith Lucas speaker today. I first met Trina Williams when she was a doc student at Washington University more than a decade ago. Let me tell you a little bit about her. She's currently an associate professor at the University of Michigan and a faculty associate at the Survey Research Center. Before that, she was an undergrad student in business administration. If you get a little of this history, you'll understand how she got to her topic today. So, an undergraduate degree in business administration. She was a Peace Corps volunteer in Ecuador, doing community development, I believe. And then got a master's in philosophy at Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar. That master's was in comparative social work, or social research, I'm sorry. And then subsequently got an MSW and then the PhD at Washington University in St. Louis. Her research interests include things like individual development accounts, and she's worked with promoting these in public housing, among public housing residents. Also 529 college education plans, but for Head Start families. She's currently involved in a summer youth employment in Detroit, and so in these and other ways has done research on assets, poverty, economic development, and connections to child well-being. She's interested in public policy for families and in social and economic development, especially in urban communities. So for these reasons, I'm just really proud that you're with us today. And would like the rest of you to help me welcome Katrina Trina to this class.
Okay, well, thank you, Terry, for that wonderful introduction, and thanks to Rick and all of the committee for inviting me here for this lecture today. I'm excited to be able to share some of the things that I've been doing and hopefully inspire some interesting things to be happening in congregations throughout the country. So this is a quick overview of some of the things I'm going to talk about today. Just give some basic statistics on economic inequality with an emphasis on wealth inequities. Give some biblical myths and principles for stewardship of financial management. An introduction to the concept of asset building, which Terry started to talk about a little bit a few minutes ago. And then end with some suggestions on how churches might be able to improve financial capability of its members and the community. So let's see if we can get through this quickly. Overview of economic inequality. Okay, so this is just a basic chart of what has happened in income in the U.S. from 1979 until maybe 5 years ago. And if you'll see, the most gains went to the very top 1%, and then the next 20% had income double over this period of time, and everyone else kind of stayed flat over this period. So you can see that, at least over the last 30 years, the people at the top have been getting much higher income, and those at the bottom have stayed kind of stagnant. And if you're looking at wealth inequality, it's even worse. So this is just a rendition to show that if 1% of the country would own about 50% of the wealth, and the top 10% would own about 90% of the wealth, and then the bottom 40% would have almost nothing, just that red little dot at the bottom. And then to show this, what this means in real dollars, the bottom fifth has zero or negative net worth. They don't have anything of value. They have more debt than they have assets. And then the top quintile has about 86 times the second quintile, about 9 times the third quintile, and about 3 times the fourth quintile. And if you look between 2000 and 2011, the top got even more, again, just like in income. If you want to see exactly how the portfolios kind of map out in the country, you can see that the top 10% are much more likely to have stocks and mutual funds and to have pension accounts. And the only place where there's almost equity in terms of the proportion of the population is for debt. So the bottom 90% has about the same amount of debt as they represent the population, but everything else in wealth, they don't. In terms of principal residence, at least some people, the people who do have money, they have it in, they have wealth in a home. And so it's a little more equal there, but you can see that the distribution of wealth and how it's concentrated, it's, at least in terms of things that are allowed to make more money over time, things like stocks and bonds, are much more likely to be held at the top 10% of the population. These disparities are even worse by race. So if you look between, in this case, 1981 and 2010, blacks and blacks, non-Hispanic blacks and Latinos tend to have maybe 5 to 10 cents on the dollar as non-Hispanic white families. And then you can also see that it got worse after 2008, after the recession. So the racial wealth disparities actually got worse over the last 10 years instead of better. And this is some work I've done showing how it affects children. So if you look at children who were born in 2001, these are kids who are like 15, 16-year-old now, they live in very different circumstances depending on race. So if you look on the far end of the scale, the bluish, the cool colors, about half of white kids are in were born into families that have more than twice the poverty line and have every type of asset that was measured. So a home, money in the bank, and stocks and bonds. In contrast, if you look at Latinos, African Americans and American Indians, they're more likely to be in the red, so that they're less than the poverty line and they don't have assets. And so it just shows, even starting out by race, people start in very different circumstances. Here, this is a friend of mine, Mariko Chang, and she shows wealth differences by gender. And you'll see particularly that gender gaps don't exist as much in income, but are much greater in wealth. And to show this even more, you can see that for couples, men and women tend to have at least somewhat closer, but if you look at single females and single males, there's huge disparities between how much wealth is held by females and how much wealth is held by males. I'd like to stop here for a second. Has anyone heard about the grand challenges in social work? Has anybody been participating in those at all? They were announced last year at SSWR. And so if anyone is really interested in actually making a difference in these areas around economic inequality, the purpose of the grand challenges is to help champion social progress by science and research, and to actually have a call to action to actually help tackle some of our nation's toughest problems. So in terms of the general categories, they have some challenges that deal with individual and family well-being, some challenges that deal with building a stronger social fabric, and then some that deal with building a just society that fights exclusion, marginalization, and creates a sense of well-being to promote trust and offer pathways for social and economic progress. And I actually serve as one of the co-leads for the Grand Challenge for Reducing Extreme Economic Inequality. So if you're really interested in this, I can add you to our mailing list and we can kind of talk about where we're going to go forward over the next 3 to 5 years. There's also a Grand Challenge around building financial capability for all. So at least parts of the Grand Challenge that are being taken on by the Academy of Social Work is actually around things that deal with economic inequities. But rather than talking about where we are, I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking about some principles for stewardship and financial management. Before I even go into that, I'm going to talk about 10 myths. And I need to give credit. Dwight Nichols, who happens to be my father, wrote this book, God's Plan for Your Finances. So these 10 myths that I come up with are actually from his book. So, myth number one, money is the root of all evil. It's corrupt and leads people astray, so you shouldn't be concerned about money or material possessions. You might even be stealing from people if you have money, right? A thought that maybe some people might have about money. Some people say Jesus had nowhere to lay his head. Jesus was poor, had no worldly possessions, so as followers of Jesus, we should be poor as well. Matthew 19:24 talks about it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to go into heaven. So, if you take that to its extreme conclusion, you can't have worldly wealth on earth and be expected to go to heaven, too. In Luke 18, Luke told the young ruler to sell all his possessions and give his money away. Therefore, if you really love Jesus and want to serve God, you should take a vow of poverty, and you'll obtain your riches when you get to heaven. And some might say that preachers just want to get your money. Money's part of this world's economic system. Christians are supposed to be heavenly-minded, and therefore church can only function as a place to worship God and stay out of people's business and personal affairs. Another one, God answers prayers. Therefore, if you really trust in Jesus and exert faith, he'll meet all your financial needs. You don't have to do anything about your circumstances. Just pray, take one day at a time, and things will work out. Hebrews 13:5 says, be content with what you have. Therefore, don't worry about planning ahead. got to take care of your circumstances. Even if you're born poor on the wrong side of the tracks, there's nothing you can do about it. Just be content with where you are. And then one of the final ones, Jesus is only interested in spiritual things, not material things. Therefore, it's wrong to talk about money in church. Church is not the place for that sort of thing. And then the Deuteronomy, there's a verse that you shouldn't charge your brother interest. Therefore, if you took this to its logical conclusion, you shouldn't have any savings or investment accounts if it gives you interest. And then again, you're not supposed to lay up treasures in heaven. If you hoard money on earth, you shouldn't have surpluses or savings accounts. Having bank accounts limits your trust in God. As you probably can tell, each of these myths is actually a distorted biblical principle. So rather than saying the love of money is the root of all evil, it just says the money is the root of all evil. Rather than saying that you should never put things before God, so you should not, if you had to choose between God and mammon, you should choose God, but they're not mutually exclusive. So it's possible to be a good steward of what God has given you and not necessarily have to take a vow of poverty. And so when I start to talk about some of these things that churches can do, hopefully if you have any of these myths or ideas in your head, you can start to see that maybe churches are places where maybe some of these ideas can be discussed. So particularly if you look at Luke, Matthew, with the parable of the sower, there's a lot of biblical principles about being a good steward, about what God has given you. Rather than just burying your money and putting it in the ground, actually try to invest and try to make it grow over time. And also, the Bible talks about if you're faithful with money, then you're also probably going to be faithful with spiritual things. So just some basic principles before I start talking about asset building. So hopefully it won't seem like I'm coming out of the left field when I'm talking about these things in a Christian or a church context. So I'm going to do a slight introduction to asset building. This is some of the work that I've been doing for a while. And before I even talk about some of the projects that I'm on, I want to give just a few principles to kind of put this into some context. So this is a quote from the Roberts Foundation. The need for economic solutions to poverty is well known. You cannot escape the fact that you do not service people out of poverty. At its core, the ability to exit poverty is a question of employment, asset accumulation, and wealth creation. So you've heard if you give a person a fish, she eats for a day. If you give a teach a person a fish, they'll eat for life. You can think of a postscript. The parable of it really matters is who owns the pond with the fish. And so the reason that I spend a lot of time thinking about this is that owning assets actually give people a stake in the future, a reason to save, to dream, to invest their time, effort, and resources in creating a future for themselves and their children. And so if you're living from day to day, don't have any economic resources, it's much harder to dream about the future, and it's much harder for your children to think their future is going to be something that's worth living. And so a friend of mine, Connie Evans, actually talks about a continuum of asset building strategies. So if you're a person who's unemployed, doesn't have any basic skills, and don't have any economic resources, and are in a household or in a community that is low income and low wealth, it's kind of hard to jump right into asset building. So she would suggest that maybe some basic adult education, actually getting a job, and then maybe you can start thinking about moving up in terms of education, and then eventually savings and financial literacy, and then maybe to the point then where you can think about the more what people really think about when they think about asset building. So starting businesses, buying a home, creating jobs. But you don't just jump from having nothing to being wealth creator, but as you take steps along the way, no matter how much money you earn, you can start saving some to get to a point where you can be better over time. But I'm going to now introduce this concept of individual development accounts that Terry talked about earlier. Actually, when I was at Washington University, my dissertation chair was Michael Sheraton, and he actually introduced this concept of individual development accounts. And his basic insight was that public policy for low-income families usually favored consumption or survival, but not really wealth creation or economic mobility. So if you give people food stamps, if you give people temporary shelter, that's great because you can survive and take care of yourself in the moment, but they're usually not things that help people get ahead. So one idea that he came up with is this idea of individual development accounts. So if an individual saves money in the individual development account, they get a match. Sometimes the match may be 2-to-1, sometimes it may be 3-to-1. So if they save $10, they'll get $30 in that individual development account. And the real twitch of this is that if you save and you get match, it has to be used for asset building purpose. So to buy a home, to get education, to start a business, sometimes for retirement, depending on the program. But the idea is that as individuals save for themselves, they get incentives and they get extra money to help them reach their asset building goals quicker. And the one thing that from this research that really started in the mid-80s showed that even very low-income families do save, and actually they save a higher proportion of their income often than more well-off families. And so, if you give opportunities like individual development accounts, low-income families get excited, they save, they also often get financial education to help make wise choices around home ownership and education. But it's a project that started in the 80s. Now it's funded, we'll see what happens in the next couple of years, but it has been funded through Health and Human Services, through what's called the Assets for Independence Act. And so what happens is a local organization applies to HHS, and they usually have to get a local match, but they can create these individual development accounts in their local communities. And so it went from being a research idea to public policy and to helping families throughout the country. But rather than waiting for someone to earn less than twice the poverty line, I actually spent time thinking about child development accounts. So rather than waiting until someone is earning less than twice the poverty line and really struggling economically, what happens if you start younger? What happens if you start with children? So child development accounts are actually these same kind of match savings accounts, these same sort of investment accounts, but for lifelong developmental purposes. And the original vision for Michael Sharon, at least, was to open early, ideally at birth, and if not at birth, in preschool or in kindergarten. So there's a long time horizon for compound interest. You also want it to be universal so that many people can have access to such accounts, and then progressive, so the most low-income families and are the ones you're going to have the highest matches and get the most incentives. So that's the idea. If you ask, where does this exist in the world? In the UK, they created something called a child trust fund where every child born in the UK got £500 in an account. Well, £250 if they're low income, £500 to use for education or whatever purposes once they got to be 21. In Singapore, they have a really interesting set of programs. At birth, if you have matched savings, it can go toward developmental purposes. So if you need to go to a doctor, if you need some sort of medical attention, if you need developmentally appropriate toys, from 0 to 5, kind of, it could be used for educational purposes, educationally appropriate purposes. And then from 5 to whenever they in secondary school, it's going to a college savings account, so it's going to be used for education purposes. And then, if they haven't used all that money in education, it goes to the Central Provident Fund, which is their equivalent of Social Security. So it's seriously a lifelong series of accounts for age-appropriate purposes. And so that doesn't exist in the U.S., but it does exist in Singapore as an example. In San Francisco, they have the kindergarten to college program. And then I've also been part of something called the SEED demonstration, which is saving for education, entrepreneurship, and down payment. And all of these programs usually have some common components. Usually there's an initial deposit of some sort. In the UK, it was £250 or £500. In Singapore, I don't know exactly how much it was, but there is an initial starting point. In San Francisco, they start with $50 from the state treasurer's coffers. And then for SEED, we started out in some places, the one that I work with at least, with $1,000 for Head Start families. So whatever that initial endowment is, it kind of gets the account started. Then you have to make a decision about account type. Some places choose bank accounts, just regular passbook savings accounts. But of course, in these days, they don't make much interest, so you kind of keep what you have over that period of time. And so some places have actually used the state 529 college saving plans, which usually goes into investment accounts, which means that over time, you have a chance for the money to grow at a slightly higher rate. And then you also make decisions about access. So can you use it for anything that's developmentally appropriate, that's approved by some entity? Can it only be used for college? Or then maybe can it only be used for asset building purposes like the IDA accounts? So these are the sort of decisions you make if you're creating a child development account. But the idea is you start from birth or early in life, and you help the family and the child to think over time what they want their future to be and how they're going to save and prepare for that. This is some research that comes out of the University of Kansas, Willie Elliott and his team. And what's interesting here is he shows that low-income families, even if they have very little amounts in an account in the child's name, even as little as $500, low-income children are more likely to enroll in college and then to graduate from college. So 3 times more likely to enroll in college if they have at least $500 or as little as $500 in an account in their own name, and they're 4 times more likely to graduate. So, of course, college doesn't cost $500. It usually costs a lot more. But it shows, and some research I've been able to show, is that usually the parent and the child start talking about these accounts. They start talking about expectations for the future, and it allows people to be more engaged in school. The program I helped start in Lansing, Michigan, we actually have activities in the school where the children bring, you know, $1.50 to deposit in their accounts or $2 to deposit in their accounts, and they have activities in school around savings, around thinking about college, around what do you want to be when you grow up. And so all those conversations that don't always happen in low-income families, or if they don't think they have the money to pay for it, these little bitty accounts at least get to the point where they start thinking about it and thinking maybe it's for them. So this is the research from University of Kansas. 3 times more likely to enroll in college, 4 times more likely to graduate, even with as little as $500 in an account in their name. I don't know if Stephanie's in the room, but Stephanie, Bonnie, and I have come up with some ideas. So if you take some of these individual asset building strategies I just talked about, so IDAs, individual development accounts, CDAs, child development accounts, but they're even more powerful if you combine them with community-based economic development strategies, because then you get to the point where you are helping individual families build assets, but you're also building resources and assets at the community level. And so these are some ideas she and I came up with. At the individual level, you have matching incentives, and there need to be things for all levels of household income. So for low-income households, for middle-income households, and upper-income households. Even though upper-income households usually have financial counselors who help them think through this, but all levels of households can use asset-building principles. And then at the collective level, you can do some modeling and create infrastructure to help your community and families within your community build wealth. So, of course, I'm going to talk today about churches and faith-based institutions, but there could be neighborhood resident associations, civic organizations, and even sororities, fraternities that could do some of this sort of thing. So I know this is a complicated picture, and we don't have to go through all of them, but this is the kind of idea that we had. So if you're looking at low-income families, you can have things like individual development accounts that exist in the country. You can help people invest their EITC refunds. There's a lot of research going on lately about households. If they save a bit of their tax refund, they can get a match and use that, not necessarily for asset building purposes, but for emergency savings and things to just provide a little more economic security. There's a lot of home ownership programs that exist for low-income families to help them not only to save for a home, but make sure that they get a mortgage product that isn't going to rip them off, and that they're going to be able to afford and be able to last and not go into foreclosure. If you go to more middle-income families, there's IRAs that already exist, which is individual retirement accounts, which exists at the federal level. Often people have employer-based programs like 401ks or 403bs. The state college savings plans, traditionally in the U.S., that's for middle and upper-income households invest in college savings plans, which is why it's a good idea for either churches or community-based organizations to help create those sort of incentives for low-income families to also save for their children's college. Middle-income households sometimes do real estate. I'm not going to go through all of these, but there's a whole bunch of things you do across the income spectrum, and then there's all sorts of things you can do at the institutional or community level. So rather than just building assets for individual families, you can have risk pools for things like insurance, so you can pay less as a group if you go in as a group to get insurance. You can have housing co-ops, so rather than being able to put a down payment and pay for a house by yourself, you may buy a 2 or 3 family flat or high rise, and then you each pay into some of it, and you own it collectively. You can do investment clubs. You can have micro-enterprise co-ops. So oftentimes people think about starting businesses as individuals, but you can also do it cooperatively. There's a lot of restaurants that do that way. So they start the business, they invest in the infrastructure and the location, and then they share the earnings amongst themselves. Obviously, there's community development corporations. There's all sorts of things that can happen at the community level as well as the individual level. And so, obviously, if you're trying to build wealth in low-income communities, you can start to bring investment in the communities themselves as well as help families. And so then the question comes, what are ways that churches can participate in these sort of things? So I have... now I'm going to talk about a few suggestions for ways that churches might help improve financial capability. But before going into the ideas, I want to just step back and say that the places that actually have face-to-face contact with a lot of low-income families in a place that is safe and a place that meets their needs is often churches, right? So even though government sometimes can reach and community-based organizations can reach, churches oftentimes spend more time on a regular basis with low-income families. So the question is, how can they engage in some of these ideas and activities to help improve financial capability, to reduce some of those huge economic disparities that I talked about earlier in both income and wealth? So, one idea is just this idea of financial training to support congregants and communities in reaching financial goals and reducing debt. So this would include using books and resources from individuals like my dad, Dwight Nichols, or from Dave Ramsey and his financial university. And it's just really bringing people together, the congregation, to learn basic financial principles, to kind of commit as a group to maybe not use as much credit and debt, and maybe use things for investing and for saving for the future. And again, sometimes these things seem pretty self-explanatory, but at least in the research I've done for the families, for example, Head Start families, when you talk to the parents, they say, my family didn't teach me about investing or saving money. I didn't learn it at school. When I got to be an adult, I had to figure it out on my own. And so when you have to figure it out on your own, you're usually going to make some mistakes. And so whether you're a person who your first day of college signs up for a credit card and spends up more than you can afford to pay back, or whether you, again, get a mortgage or something that isn't good for you or that you can't afford, if you have an opportunity to, as a congregation, to talk through these issues, to talk about financial principles, to put it in a spiritual context, but also to have people who can encourage you and motivate you to do things differently, that's something that a church can help do. In addition, if a congregation has members that specialize in banking or financial coaching or who work in the housing or real estate arena, allow them to offer workshops and consultations. So rather than having people have this expertise but not actually share within their congregation but just outside the congregation, it's a way that churches can help bring people together around this idea of financial training and supporting congregants in both reaching long-term financial goals and just reducing debt. Another possibility is entrepreneurship and cooperative businesses. So this could mean something really simple, just by allowing vendors to set up some day a month or once a year or something like that, or having some sort of directory to promote products and services offered by the members of the congregation. That's the easy first step. But it also might mean actually establishing a business or some profit-generating activities as a congregation and allow members to contribute and receive earnings and be part of that process. It could also mean offering support and assistance so members can launch their own small businesses. And so kind of having a small business incubator, and to have people who understand about the financial performers that can help people kind of figure out what a cost point is for their small business. Or maybe they can start in the church or using space in the church and over time, you know, have their own location. But offering support and assistance so that members can launch their own small businesses and have things that are asset building and not just consumption. And then finally, this idea of sponsoring the ideas I spoke about before, individual development accounts or child development accounts, or any other asset building efforts as a congregation. So this might require some planning. It might mean hiring staff to oversee this work. And you can do it either by applying for the federal funding that exists through Assets for Independence, through HHS, through foundation fundings to help pay for some of the matches. But at least the congregation I worked with in Nashville, they actually created their own local program. And the way they did it, they had many people in the congregation who every year gave to United Way. And so they found a way for the congregation to give to what we call Christian Community Services Incorporated. And so they used the money that went through there as the match for low-income housing families who wanted to start saving for a home or for school or for a small business. So obviously, if you want to apply for federal dollars, there's a 501c3 and there's different requirements you have to meet. But if you're able to raise the money as your local congregation, you can set your own parameters on how you want to do it and what you want the eligibility to be and what you want the uses to be and what sort of support you provide people in the congregation. So whether you fundraise to establish your own programming or use existing funds, it's this idea of helping people think for the future, and whether you decide to do a 50-50 match, whether you do a 2-to-1 match, 3-to-1 match, whatever it is, the idea is within the congregation you're thinking about how can you help families build assets to build wealth, how can we collectively do better financially and economically. I'd love to see what questions or comments or ideas you guys have about this, because what I'm hoping will happen here is that these ideas are planted, that maybe some of the congregations you're a part of will maybe try some of these ideas. And if you're really, really, really interested, at 2 o'clock, myself and Stephanie Boddy are doing a workshop called Making Assets Work for the Church. So taking a lot of these ideas that we have kind of in general and kind of diving deeper to talk about how you might be able to do it as a congregation. So I'll stop here and see if I have any questions.
Good. I'll set up a mic.
Sure.
Let folks know how we'll do that.
Yep. And if any of you guys are already doing some of these things, I'd love to hear about it.
Talking about, but focused more on workforce development than on wealth building strategies. I've done some with my agency some individual development accounts, which have been okay, but I haven't gotten huge results. But I haven't been doing them a long time either. And obviously, there's some limited resources available. I'm particularly interested in the business incubator idea, and am exploring right now the idea of setting up tradesmen's units in some extra space so that we could provide space for very small businesses to get started and be able to provide connections with community for employment and others. But the biggest challenge that I'm finding is funding and resources to be able to operate programs like this. I'm not sure how churches could do them on a significant level. We're a faith-based community nonprofit that's church partners, but any thoughts related to business incubator, I'd love to hear more about that.
Well, literally the session we do next with Stephanie Boddy, she actually, with a church in Pittsburgh, has helped create healthy foods and gardens, aquaponics, different pieces to help the church come together, small in the building at first, but they've actually bought property and actually expanded over time. But I think if you, well, I'll go two ways. In communities, there are a lot of churches that do have resources, and finding ways to partner is one way of thinking about it. But if you are a congregation that doesn't internally have your own resources, you got to start small and build over time. There's foundation funding. There are people who are doing this kind of as their job who can bring it into the church. So there's ways you can start small and grow. Maybe rather than starting at the individual level and helping households build wealth, you start figuring out how you as a congregation can have some of these things to build wealth so you can have money to do some of the good that you want to do over time. But on the idea about work development, if you have people who are in the trades and who know how to do things, having the training happen internally, and particularly started with young people, that's a good way to kind of at least get people in good jobs, and over time you can do some little bit of saving. Right? Thank you for those ideas.
I just want to just share with you that American Baptist Churches USA have a number of different arms to it where they do these things already. So they're all, I mean, they have a national credit union, and they have other investment arms for churches to, you know, to do this. And so the national headquarters is in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. But they will send people from Valley Forge to any church in America, any American Baptist church in America, who would want to do these things. The problem is that you have a lot of churches, a lot of congregations, you know, who just don't seem to get into these things. Some of them do, but many of them don't, you know, and so that's a major problem. Now, I say that from personal experience, being an American Baptist pastor who has pastored a number of different churches around the country, and I've pastored black churches and white churches. And it's really hard, you know, to try to get people excited and motivated to do these things.
Thank you. I don't know if I have an answer to that, but I think I would say that if there are resources that people will come out and do some consultation and some TAC, at least knowing what those resources are is a good starting point. And I would also say I've been in congregations where they made announcements, for example, to do Financial University by Dave Ramsey. Maybe 8 families came out of a congregation of 300. And you could say that's a problem. That was something that was bad. But for those 8 families, we did really well. And then the next time we did it, more families came. So you have to start somewhere. But I would say that if the leader of the congregation, the pastor or the deacons or the elders, whoever, whatever you have in the leadership of the congregation, if they don't have the vision for it, it's a lot harder to get it going. That's for sure. And if there's other thoughts or questions, please come up. But I want to say one more thing. This project we started with SEED, that was with Head Start Families. We started in 2004. We offered the 529 College Savings Plan for 4 years to 2008. And just this last year, I actually did follow-up interviews with families. And so we interviewed 50 families and 29 young people. And what was so exciting about it is these are very low-income families. These are Head Start families. Some of them were doing just as badly in 2017 as they were in, or 2016 as they were in 2004. But only 9% took any money out of these college savings accounts for their kids. So when you asked them why not, they said, this is for my kids' future. Even though I'm doing poorly, even though I'm having difficulties, I'm not going to touch this account that was put up for my family. And some of the foundations were a little nervous because in order to get the match from the state, we put the accounts in the child's name. So the parents could take out any time they wanted to. And like I said, 9% did, but over 10 years, only 9% of families withdrew that money because they really, really saw it for their children's future. And so it's just a way to show that when these things are put into place, it can make a difference.
Hello, my name is Charles Rowe.
Hello.
I'm here with my wife, Elizabeth Patterson Rowe. And we've moved into an impoverished area of Akron, Ohio, to do community and economic development work. We've partnered with a ministry that's been there for 20 years called South Street Ministries, and they're putting together a Christian business incubator that I'm hoping to be involved with and perhaps champion. And I'm also thinking of maybe doing some financial literacy training with people eventually in the South Akron area. And I've taught Financial Peace University, I've taught Crown Financial Ministries, I've taught I Was Broke But Now I'm Not, I've taught a half a dozen different curricula. But they all seem to be geared towards the middle class. And I'm looking for a curriculum that I can roll out for the urban poor specifically. I didn't know if you had any recommendations.
Well, really, I usually start with those things and then just modify them. The other thing that we found that worked, particularly in the financial classes, you have people from the communities who've had some successes in financial empowerment, in maybe some savings, and maybe some of these ideas, so that when they come back and talk to the community, they have a little more, they're usually more accepted, right? So, and then what else happens is the examples that often come from, like, say, Financial Peace University, the numbers are much higher, you're talking $10,000, you're talking about these more complicated, you know, investment products. But then when you have people in the community, well, they're talking about $10,000, but look what I was able to do with $200, right? And so if you could get people who kind of understand the concepts to kind of co-teach with you so they can bring examples from their own lives and their own communities, that helps. I mean, ideally, you'd have a curriculum that was only set up for very, very low-income families, but if they don't exist, you need to at least modify what exists and get people from the community to help. That's at least what we did.
I wanted to provide a suggestion. I spent several years researching this question, and I found the FDIC has a free curriculum called Money Smart that's very well geared towards low-income households. Yeah.
That's true, too. Absolutely. Money Smart.
Nobody minding the story. Find a spot. There you go. I think you might have heard some energy around NACSW doing some service in the cities in which we have our conventions. And would there be a possibility that if we did some planning with a congregation or faith community, advanced planning, that we would be able to do some asset-based development as part of our give back to the community in which we're having our convention, and just ideas you might have?
That's a great suggestion. Usually what happens, particularly on the IDA or CDA account, you're not talking about lots of money. You're talking about having, you can limit the amount of money. So it could be a match as little as $500 or $1,000. So if you can kind of get a congregation to say that we'll work with you and we can raise some money locally and we'll launch something in our own communities. So maybe you can kind of provide, with people coming from all over the country, you can provide some seed funding for these ideas that a congregation might have. But you'd have to find congregations who are trying to start something, and you can kind of say we can do some seed, both in terms of providing some resources and some intellectual capital from social workers throughout the country. And then if you wanted to set it up, you could do some sort of a kiva or a match or something like that to make sure that they could take their own projects and their own ideas, but we could all kind of contribute to it, and then we can kind of see it launched in a local community. But I mean, you have to find the churches who are interested in doing those sort of things. You have to kind of maybe do a call in the city where are we going next?
Charlotte.
So you could do a call in Charlotte to see if there's congregations there who are interested in doing some of these asset building or these economic development type principles.
Thank you for joining us today for NACSW's Podcast of the Month featured selection. We hope you found today's session useful and that it will support your efforts to thoughtfully integrate Christian faith and social work practice. We also hope that you will consider participating in additional NACSW's activities and events, including NACSW's upcoming convention in the fall, our quarterly audio conference workshops that we offer at no cost to NACSW members, and which includes free CEUs accredited by the Association of Social Work Boards, our online continuing education program, and access to dozens of archived podcasts from the members section of our website. Also, we invite you to join NACSW's Facebook group or our Facebook fan page. For additional information about these and other NACSW benefits and services, you can go to our website at www.nacsw.org. Thanks again for listening in today to our podcast session today.